This is the Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on December the 29th, 2000. Our speaker is Lee N. of Scotts Valley, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Like to do a few housekeeping things, and I'd like to welcome the new people tonight, and I'd also like to welcome the people that have heard me talk before, and I thank them for coming anyway. Saturday Night Live is my home group. 8:30 a.m. Sunday morning, Great Fact Meeting is my home meeting. And as I look around the room, there's maybe four or five people in the room tonight that were here at my first meeting. It was that Sunday morning, and I thank them for being here. When I first started coming around to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were a few people that were saying that because of the way that I look, that perhaps I didn't belong here, or I hadn't earned my seat or paid enough price to get here. And what I can tell you tonight is that I've spent time in the Norwalk jail. I've spent time in Downey jail. I've spent time in L.A. County jail, which is a real treat. If you haven't been there, I don't recommend it. And I couldn't leave Northern California out, so I also spent time in the Santa Cruz County jail. And my beautiful wife sitting over there in the corner of 30 years of marriage can assure you that I belong in this room with the rest of you. So, you know, it wasn't that long ago that in order to speak in front of this many people, I would have needed to take a few drinks. And tonight, I'll share it with you a little bit about what I do, and it kind of goes like this. I say, God, if I get called on today at the meeting, please help me say something that would be of help to someone in the audience. Give me the courage, the strength, and the wisdom to speak and to do your will, and perhaps I can carry the message that those who might need to hear it. And I found that even tonight, I'm a professional salesman. I've been in my business for 33 years, and I am consistently in front of people, groups way larger than this, and still scared to death and nervous as ever. And it was alcohol that allowed me to do that for many, many years. And since that's no longer an option, I've had to resort to different things, and my sufficient substitute has been Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was a young man, well, before I even get to that, let me tell you how I happen to be here tonight. I spend a lot of my time in the summers in Montana, and that came about, my wife found a place up there 10 years ago. And she goes up there in May and stays up there until October every summer. And I go back and forth as I can. And I come back in October, and I don't participate in AA as much as I do during the rest of the year. So one of the things that I found myself doing is I'll ask my higher power if there's something that I can do now that I'm back in town, if there's something that I can do to get into action and be of service to my fellows. And you hear around here every now and then that you should watch out what you pray for. Because no sooner did these words leave my subconscious. And I got asked to chair a couple of meetings in Los Gatos, groups that I go to. Billy D. grabbed me and asked me to do this meeting. I was elected president of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependency. It's a nonprofit group for alcoholics and addicts. And that was all as a courtesy of my friend Neil. I don't know if you know Neil, older gentleman, who is a good friend. And he's got me in that, and I've now completed 5 years with that organization. But if that wasn't enough, I come into the Friday noon meeting, and my good friend Little John's sitting over there in his usual corner, and Danny, excuse me, is secretarying the meetings, and Danny has been quite a servant to the group over the years. And she comes up to me and she says, "Lee, you know, I bought a house in Boulder Creek, and I could this could be my last meeting if you would be good enough to take over the Friday meeting." And I said, "Danny, you know, I haven't taken the secretary workshop, and if it wasn't for that, I probably could help you out, but I just won't be able to do it." And Danny says, "Lee, I'm the chairperson of the workshop committee." She said, you be here next Friday, and I'll give you a personal meeting," which she did. The whole time I'm sitting there getting greased up, Little John is back going like this. And the difference between he and I, he knows how to say no better than I do, is the problem. So anyway, I came in and got into service, and I did that. And then I ran for re-election because I didn't want to be like President Ford and be appointed, you know, in charge and then be defeated the next time around. So I ran for election, and I have that meeting now. And you know, it's the first I've secretaried a couple meetings here at Live. But this was the first one that I ever got elected to. And, you know, when I left the meeting that night, I could have sworn I just, you know, won the presidency of the United States. I was so excited over it. It was really kind of a neat thing. So anyway, after that happened, I said, "Okay, God, I think that's sufficient." And so now this is why you're stuck with me tonight. When I was a very young man, I had came from a good family, actually born and raised here in San Jose, lived here all my life. My parents were good people, not alcoholic. They did the best they could. They were poor people. But we always had, my two sisters and I, we always had everything that we could ever think of having. But, you know, people looked at me and thought, you know, they called me a shy person. And as I grew up and started to get ready to go out and do business, I found that my shyness wasn't really shyness at all, but it was fear. I started a business at 22 years of age, which 33 years later I'm still doing. I've had very good success in this business. But that business required me to go door to door. And for the first month of doing this, I threw up every morning. I was so afraid to go door to door that it just upset me so much that I would have that reaction. But like a fool, I didn't pay any attention, and I kept doing it. And I toughed that out for years. I got married at 19. My first marriage was at 19. My wife was 18, and this is back in a day when 19 and 18-year-olds were really that age. We struggled, and after 4 years of marriage, she decided to get rid of me. Well, at that time, I had no social graces at all. I didn't know how to meet people. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know what to do. I was in this business. I was doing okay. And I thought, how am I going to meet anybody? You know, I'm afraid to approach women. I'm afraid to dance. And if I did, I wouldn't know what to do. And so it dawned on me that I needed to go to bars. And that's where I could find women and make my move. Well, but I still had a big enough ego, even though I was afraid. I had a big enough ego that I thought it would be best if I tested this drinking thing first. Because see, now I'm 24, almost 25 years old. Still didn't drink. Had a couple drinks in high school and those kind of things, but never on a regular basis. So now I'm getting a little older. But I thought it would be best if I test out the booze. So what I did is I locked myself in my house for two consecutive weekends. And I chose to drink rum and coke. And I drank rum and coke all day and all night long on both weekends, Saturday and Sunday. And man, I just got blottoed. And didn't like the taste, and I was sick as a dog. But what I found out in those couple times is that I wouldn't make a fool of myself. I could hold it pretty good. It took a lot of booze before I started getting sick or having trouble with it. And this was the beginning of my drinking career. And all of a sudden it came back to me. All those years that I suffered, toughing it out, tearing my guts out to do things on my own, and the acid in my stomach, dealing with people one-on-one, talking in front of people, all of a sudden, that liquor was the cure-all. And I can remember as clear as it was today that why couldn't I have found this booze 5 years, 6 years earlier? I thought that I had just found the cure to all the ills of the world. And all of a sudden, when I drank that booze, which I still didn't like, the fears, the anxieties, and all those things that had caused me grief over all those years went away. And I got to tell you, man, did I love that feeling. All of a sudden, I could be in the bars. I could be as charming and as wonderful as any man would want to be. If I got put down, it made no difference because I still felt good. And a lot of times I found that I was successful as I wanted to be. When I went back to to my business, all of a sudden that going door to door and calling people on phones and going to meetings and being part of all that got better and better. Started making some money. The good thing in the early days, I wasn't making any money. But by that time I had met my bride, and she had a great job. She worked for the county, and she had all those benefits, and she was making some money. And I had just been dumped by my last girlfriend, and I was looking for somebody new. And I did some part-time work for some people, been in the insurance business, and I had to, I think it was for $400 a month, I had to spend like couple days a week in the office for three or four of my buddies, and I'd do all the grunt work for them. Well, I was looking for somebody, and as you may or may not know, on your driving records, it has your height, your weight, your hair color, and your eyes. So one of the agents came in, he says, hey, I've got this young girl, and she needs to be reinsured someplace else because she got canceled because she had two tickets. Now, this is 1970. That was terrible, two tickets. I looked at this, and I saw this 5'4", 110 pounds, blonde hair and blue eyes. I said, this is the one I want to talk to. Usually, I would just forge these apps and send them on to the next company that might take them. For her, I called up and went out on the appointment, and there she was. What a sweetheart, I have to admit. Hair down to her waist and just very attractive. The good news is that, I don't know if it's good or not, I was in it for the short term myself. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, it went a little longer than that. But we went out that night. But I would be able to go to the bars with her, and we would we'd drink a beer all night. But getting back a little bit to my business, sometimes I have to speak in front of several hundred people at a time, and I found myself being pressed a little bit more and more, and I found that I needed to drink a little bit more, and so I had an account that was a nationwide janitorial firm, And they had a big convention back in the East Coast at a golf resort. But they were a Christian organization, and there was no booze allowed. I don't know if my wife even knows this or not, but I was getting ready the next day to speak in front of this group, and of course we couldn't find any liquor, and I couldn't be seen drinking, because they figured I was, you know, like them. But I found a little liquor store, and I bought a bottle of vodka and a little can of Snappy Tom. And about 8 in the morning, I'm in the bathroom guzzling down this vodka and Snappy Tom in the bathroom, getting ready to go off on this appointment. I don't know if she knew it or didn't know it, but the beauty of it was is that when I went to talk to all those people, God, I was fantastic. I did very well. Did very well. And I had many moments like that. But you know, what happened to me is what happens to so many of us. And I hear people from the podium talking. And what happens is that all of a sudden the liquor starts to fail. It doesn't work like it used to. And for me, it started to crumble pretty good. All of a sudden, my health started to decline a bit. I had my business was suffering a little bit. But I continued to drink. I was a bar drinker. I went to bars every day. I had friends just like myself who had nothing to do but drink all day. We went to bars, preferably with a good-looking woman bartender. But we knew where they were, and we went there every single day. I've mentioned many times from the podium that I have a lady that's worked for me for 30 years and 29 days. Still with me today. The business was going pretty good. I was drinking all day in the afternoon. I was coming back to the office drunk. This woman is 4'10". She says to me, "Lee, I don't think it's good that you come home or come to the office drunk so the employees can see you." And I said, "You know, you're right." So I quit coming back to the office that night. Instead of that, I just stayed away, and if I couldn't get it done by noon, it didn't get done. But even I wasn't that bad yet. I saw that things were not working, so I needed to change my approach to this. So what I did is I still went out to drink at noon, got just half a heat on. I'd come back to the office by 3:30. I'd do a little work, get a few things done, and then I would drive home only a little bit drunk. And I'm driving over Highway 17 every day. So it came to me that what I needed to do was to go home at 3:30, 4 o'clock, which I did, drove over the hill, and I went to Peach Woods over at Pasatiempo. I then drank there from 3:30, 4 o'clock until 5:30, 6, 7 o'clock, however it worked out. But see, the beauty of that is that now when I was going home, now I'm going home against the traffic. I'm on flat ground, and there was no risk. And I thought that was brilliant. It was many, many years later that two guys sitting there in the corner pointed out, "This does not seem like what normal men would do." And it wouldn't have made any sense to me then, but it did later on after I had a little AA behind my belt. But I thought that that was a great idea. I thought things were going just fine. The whole time this is going on, I'm missing out on so many different things in life. I missed out on my relationship with my youngest daughter. My drinking and my relationship with my family had deteriorated to the point where violence was showing up. My wife didn't know whether she was safe in her own house or not. I could have turned on her in a heartbeat, and did on several occasions. I also did violence to my youngest daughter. And never once did it bother me. Or did I have any remorse. My wife felt that I was such a threat to this daughter that at 13, she turned out to be a bright little kid. She was in seventh grade, and they moved her into high school. And so, without my knowledge, she made arrangements for her to be bused from our house in Scotts Valley all the way over to Monterey to go to a school over there. Shortly thereafter, she made arrangements for this kid to live there, all to keep her away from me. All the time, not entering my mind that there was a problem. And you know, I was so sick, unbeknownst to me, that I never even cared a bit that she was not there. And she went there. She didn't want me to get involved in her activities. I went to her football games, drunk as a skunk. At one game, they were playing in, Palma High School. Her school only had 400 people in the whole school and only 25 people on the football team. And they were playing Palma, who is, even today, is still a powerhouse. And the referees were all standing around the sausage bin, you know, where they cook the big sausages. And I went over there and whipped out my wallet and I tried to give them money to give Stevenson a chance to win the game. And needless to say, this was humiliating to a young girl. And it was probably, without me even knowing it, the low point in my life, that I could act that way and humiliate somebody that I cared about and loved so much. Well, you probably think that things couldn't have got any worse. Well, at that stage of the game, the daughter was gone, and my wife of 19 years decided to get rid of me. Well, I wasn't particularly concerned about that at the time. But she pointed out to me that she was moving to Montana. So after a few moments of excitement, she decided to pack up and she moved off to Montana to live. Well, all of a sudden it dawned on me that I was by myself and that I had a pretty good, shall we say, gathering of people that I knew that I could see and go out with. And I started, for 90 days, I went out like a wild Indian. At this time, I'm 46 years old. And I'll tell you, I was out every night. I lost 23 pounds in those 90 days. My metabolism sped up to the point I was like a 20-year-old again. And I was doing things and going places, and God, it was fantastic. In the meantime, actually, I was mentioning this to Little John the other day. I go to L.A. every month on business, and I'm on the airplane because I have to, of course, after 19 years of marriage, she gets, what I like to say to rub it into a couple of fellows that I know, 50%. She was getting 50%, and every time I say that, everybody wants to know who my attorney was. But she's getting 50%, and I'm sitting down there on the plane, and there was a woman sitting next to me, and I have the yellow tablet, and I'm writing down my expenses. I put my house rent and the electricity, and then I went, ugh. And she looked over, she says, is everything all right? I said, yeah. What I'd realized is that those two items wiped out my entire half of my income. And all of a sudden, this wasn't so funny. She's off in Montana having a good old time, and I'm sitting here doing all the work, and all of a sudden, resentment starts to build. So that continued on for quite a while, and we were talking over different things. And finally, the one thing that's so beautiful about my wife, she won't hang up. I mean, you can yell and scream at her, call her every name you want, and she won't hang up on you. So finally, I'm talking to her, and we got to the point, which I can't really remember why it happened, but by this time I'm getting pretty exhausted from this lifestyle. You know, and I missed having somebody at home. I missed the cooking and all those wonderful things that go along with marriage and everything. And it dawned on me that I wanted another chance, and she was good enough to offer me another chance. But it wasn't the other chance that I wanted, for the reason you're probably thinking. You see, when she came to me and said she was leaving me, it was on her terms. And I was totally unprepared. And I didn't like the fact that she was getting, as I have liked to say many times, she was stealing my empire. She was getting half of it. I didn't like that. My plan, and many women in this group have corrected me and told me to make sure I don't forget to say part two of this, because it's not too sweet. I thought that if I got the chance to reunite with her, that what I would do is I'd get her back on my terms, and then I would go back and find all the monies, and I'd do all the good things, and then I'd really screw her up and get rid of her. And that was my plan. And then she came in, always being a little step ahead of me. She says, yeah, we can get together, but you have to go to a alcohol program. So I said, well, okay. So by this time, she comes back, and we're seeing a psychologist. This guy turns out to be a prince. He was not only a psychologist, but he was a minister and very supportive of AA. I saw this guy for 5-10 minutes when he could be ripping me off for months at the so much an hour, whatever they charge. And after a half hour, he says, you need to go to AA. Well, still keeping with my plan, I thought, well, I can do this. Well, 10 seconds later, they had me already a room reserved in O'Connor, in the old outpatient the inpatient program over there. And I'm thinking, no, this is not going to work. They convinced me that I could go to the outpatient program. But I had to be there every day for a month. Well, hell, I work. But for some reason, I agreed to it. My own greed and self-centeredness and selfishness overcame me, and I agreed to this little caveat. So they wanted me to go there that day. I said, no. I said, wait a second. I said, give me a little time here. So the next day, I end up going to the O'Connor program. And that was my introduction to any kind of alcohol treatment program. And you're in there, and I am, of course, the only one in a suit. And I look at this group, and I hear the one guy in the corner say, what the F is he doing in here? So I feel really good about this program. They have me they make you take these tests, which I didn't know at the time, but what these tests are is to make sure that you aren't going to kill somebody in the group. They want to make sure you're not prone to violence. So you take the test, and I guess I was all right. And they sent me into the group, and they gave me a counselor who had, like, at the time, 12, 13 years of sobriety, and he was a really tough guy. I mean, there were people in there that slipped a little bit and maybe took a couple Tylenols or a little of this, and he'd throw them out of the group. And I'm thinking, this is, you know. Of course, they tested you for urine samples every other time, and if they caught you there, they threw you out of there too. But in that group, there were like 7 people, men and women, young people. I was by far the oldest. And they're in there, and man, the stories they are telling really made an impact on me, because I could see that they were being so honest that it was scary to me, because there was no way in hell that I was going to be telling these people what was going on in my life. But what I found is that after a little period of time, that honesty starts to rub off. And all of a sudden, I started being a little more comfortable, a little more comfortable. Started to participate a little bit. And after a few days and maybe a couple weeks, I was starting to make progress. Well, the reason they wanted me to go to the inpatient, which some of you may or may not know, is back then, insurance paid 100% if you were inpatient, or almost 100%. Outpatient only paid about, I can't remember if it was 50-60%, but a percentage. They were getting ripped off by people not paying their bills. They preferred the insurance to pay the whole thing. That's why they wanted me to go inpatient. Well, I had the money and I paid them the deal. But the other little quirk that they throw in there is that when you're not in the group, you have to attend AA meetings. I thought, that's it. This is not going to happen. This is not going to happen. When I got my one and only drunk driving back in 87, you had to go to those classes, you know, you have to go sit down with a counselor and they give you all that good stuff. I listened to people talking about an AA meeting, the first group. I listened to what they say, and then the next week I came back to the meeting and I was able to pretend that I went to the AA meeting. And coincidentally, back in those days, I also insured Star Lodge and the camp. So that's the meeting I never went to, was at the camp. And I knew people there, and I sailed through that. But the key is I wanted to avoid going to AA. And now all of a sudden I'm faced with this. And this is where I think I made a real step forward. And I like to look at it today as my higher power working in my life without me even knowing it, without me even acknowledging a higher power. For that brief moment, I said, okay, I'll go to AA meeting. Whipped out a book, and in that book I saw the earliest meeting I could find at that time was Saturday Night Live, 8:30 a.m., Great Fact Meeting, Room 47 in Campbell. And I said, okay, that's good. Meeting at Ferris and Spencer in Los Gatos, 9 o'clock on Saturday. I said, okay, those are the two meetings I picked to go to. Armed with my little beige binder from O'Connor. And why I ever walked in here, I have never lived down since I've been here. I walked in to Sunday morning meeting in room 47 with that binder in my hand. Guy comes up and he says, ah, you're welcome here. You're from O'Connor, aren't you? And I was stunned. I didn't know how he knew. Well, turns out many people in that particular meeting had gone through O'Connor and had recognized the stupid binder. Little John was good enough to tell me that even though I was going to O'Connor, I could still come back. The funny thing about that meeting, what I think is something that's really kind of funny even to this day. I came into that meeting and Little John had been the secretary and he was chairing out. And he's sitting there in a three-piece suit chairing out. And I was feeling pretty good because I'm looking at these meetings and I'm seeing, hey, this meeting looked all right. The Sunday group, if you've ever been there, it's got some pretty reasonable looking guys. We're all mature and gray and, you know, pretty tame. The women are mature and tame. I can say that because none of them are here tonight. And he's sitting there doing his thing, and I remember, and the goofy guy called on me besides. You know when you're new at a meeting? I know we got new people in here. Don't you hate it when somebody calls on you? You're only in here for the short term, a lot of you. I know you're just here because you got to get the thing signed, and you're not going to be here forever. And the last thing you want to do is get up here and talk. Well, that was my plan, and he, of course, calls on me. And, of course, I don't remember what happened from there. But it was an awakening, only because I celebrated 10 years of sobriety on November 9th. And thank you. And Little John and John S., two of the original members from my home group, home meeting, insisted on taking me out to dinner. And I am coming from work with looking kind of like I do now. Ty was a little brighter than this. But. And I pull in. My wife is there. John S. gets out, and he's got on a coat and a tie. And I was stunned. And the first thing I think, oh, Christ, Little John is going to be embarrassed. Because, as I say tonight, he's got his sweats on, but they're his good sweats. You know, they're the nice black ones. Usually he's got the cutoffs and the no-sleeve routine. Boy, he's really going to be embarrassed tonight. Well, he pulls up, and he gets out with a double-breasted suit, French cuffs, and man, he looked just handsome as could be. Matter of fact, there were several women in the restaurant told him that he was handsome. And that is the second time that I've seen him in a suit was then. Now, the beauty of that particular moment is that we took pictures of everybody. And I really wanted these pictures because it was a landmark. Well, my wife, God bless her, did something with the camera and the pictures didn't come out. And I said, do you realize that I'm going to have to, let's see, I'm going to be in my middle 60s by the time he'll wear a suit again and we won't be able to have a picture because you screwed him up. No, I didn't say that. But fortunately, John S. has some pictures. And the only reason I mention that at this point in my story is because that is the love that I have found in this room. Anybody that knows Little John knows that he hates to dress up. And I tell you, I was quite, and he did it one other time too, when Neil's wife passed away. And you know, I talked to Neil quite a bit, and he told me how much he appreciated that fact. And you know, for the normal person running around and everything, what the hell does that, you know, who cares? But you know, from where I come from, that's a big deal. And it's the extra effort that I have found that alcoholics make for one another to make this program what it is today. But getting back to my meeting career, so I started going there, getting my slip signed, and you know the damn thing about it is that November 9th, if you look, you got all the holidays in there, that 30 days. So I had to go to meetings on Thanksgiving and on the Friday, then on Christmas and then on New Year's, and I'm going to all these stupid AA meetings. And I got up and I got to hear people talk. Most of them are still here today at Saturday Night Live. And while I was in the room, all of a sudden, all my bad motives started to disappear. No longer was I thinking about taking my wife out and cheating her and taking advantage of her. No longer was I thinking just of myself and how things would affect me and how my life would change whether I was sober or drunk. And just for those few weeks of sobriety, all of a sudden, a little bit of sanity started to return to my life. For the first time, a little sanity started to come back into my mind. And I started to take a look at some of the things that I had done. I started listening to people from this podium, this very podium, starting to talk about their troubles and their difficulties. And I found myself gravitating to some of the men in this room that have been married one time and have been successful at it. Started listening how they have done things And all of a sudden, a little bit more started creaking in. Because when I came in here, and you look at the steps, and you hear the people talking, and you start to hear the God word, oh boy, that for me was not a good thing. My sister, my oldest sister, is a Jehovah's Witness, and her husband is a minister, and they have been in that religion for many, many years. And not to bore you with Bible stuff, but in the Bible it says that 144,000 people will see God when heaven comes. And I'm not saying this is right or wrong. Only because if it's right, I don't want to be ruled out, right? But my older sister believes that she's one of the 144,000 that's going to go to heaven and see God. Well, again, let me say that I'm not saying it's wrong. My brother-in-law, being a minister, when my wife and I asked him to marry us, he wouldn't marry us because we didn't have religion. Now, I could kind of understand that, but being a potential alcoholic, not knowing I was that bad yet, I had a huge resentment over that. And I like to tell him today, well, now I'm married to the same woman for 30 years, so I guess something worked. Well, it turned out to be Alcoholics Anonymous, not necessarily religion. So this kind of a situation, I was very active. Mike Velasquez of our group here, he was in, his family was in that religion, and I loved it, and I enjoyed that. I particularly enjoyed the history of that kind of thing. But you know, my mother lived in the same mobile home park with these two, one of my two sisters, and she was very ill. And she had so many things wrong with her, it was terrible. Well, this church requires you to go door to door. And I could never understand how they could leave my mother alone when she's right there with her, when they're right there with in the same park. I mean, she couldn't clean up after herself. She could do nothing for herself. I was no better, because I was in the heights of my drinking. But my wife was good enough to take care of this woman, to have our janitor go over and clean up her apartment, clean up her mobile home, and to get her food from Meals on Wheels. And she didn't have to do that. So by the time all this comes down, and I'm getting sicker and sicker, drinking more and more, it's dawned on me that this God thing is a bunch of hokey. How can people go out door to door when their mother is over here like a piece of trash? That's what I'm thinking. So, you know, high note there. But to come in here and you see these things, you know, I'm convinced when I walked into my first meeting that they had drapes over these things. Because I hear people from this podium all the time talking about how the last thing they want to do with anything is in the God scenario. And I understand that. And I know there's people in here tonight that feel that very way. But in O'Connor, they had a spirituality class, and you read from the Hazelden 24-hour book. And this lady, not Bonnie from our group, but it was another... a former nun. She taught at O'Connor and she ran that class. She took a shine to me. She says, Lee, you have to be here. Why don't you give it a chance? And for some reason, my higher power allowed me to absorb that and to listen. And I listened. Give it a chance. And I did. Things got better. AA got better. I like some of the people that talk at this group. We got some great people. Have some great stories. But I still needed a higher power. And you know, the higher power that I chose for my first several years of sobriety was the 8:30 Great Fat Meeting. That was my higher power. And I used that group at least 2, if not 3 years. And it was sufficient for me at that time. But I come to a meeting almost every day. And I come to a meeting every day because, quite frankly, I enjoy the hell out of coming to meetings. In this room, I'm accepted for what I am. A drunk trying to get better. And maybe helping somebody out from time to time along the road. And that's what I found for my fellows in here. We'll do the same thing. And after a while of going through the steps, involving myself in the program, and working it the best I could do, I made progress, and not too long after a 4 or 5 year period of time, today my higher power is, I call God. I have a relationship with my higher power today that has turned out to be my best friend. Because you see, my wife loves me to death, and she's proven it many, many times. But she won't tell me the truth on a lot of occasions. She's supportive. She wants the best for me. So she has trouble telling me what really is on her mind or what really the truth may be for her. So I don't really get any unbiased input there. The gal at my office, same thing. 30 years relationship with her, she loves me to death. And she's proven it. But she won't tell me the important things when I come to her to ask her for something. And what I found is that with my father dying when I was young, my some mentors that I've had over the years have all died. I had no one that I could go to get some honest input. But you know what? I found that in AA. I can ask several men in this group a question, and they're going to give me an answer, not because they're smart alecks, not because they want to be show-offs, it's because they love me. And they know this is a life and death issue. Now, as Little John can tell you, I've asked him for advice on several occasions. On many a times, I don't take it. But it's progress, not perfection. Right. But you know, before we get any farther, I do want to say a couple of things about my number one priority today in my sobriety is to make amends and to do the best I can to clean up the wreckage of the past, and particularly in relationship to my family. Now, it's been pretty good. I think a lot of the fears and anxieties have left my wife. But you know, if I make just the wrong move towards her, or startle her, you know, I see that fear that comes back into her heart. And that's a subtle reminder of how it was and how it could be if I were to drink again. My youngest daughter, at 17 years old, having been slapped around on a regular basis by me, came to me and we were talking, and I pointed out to her that I was going to go through O'Connor and I was going to get sober and I'm going to be the greatest dad you ever had. You know what she says? You've said that before. Well, this kid has taken her life in her hands. But that's what she felt in her heart. She came to me after 3, 4 years of sobriety, I don't remember now. And she says, Dad, you've really done it. Good job. Thanks for being sober. What a highlight. We put on a play NCADD. Some of you probably went to see it, the play of Bill and Bob. And for that play, Dr. Bob's son, Smitty, who is now 85 years old, was in attendance and spoke at that group. I don't know if some of you were able to see that, I hope. I was fortunate enough to host a little fundraiser thing for him, and my picture ended up in the Good Times Recovery newspaper. And my wife sent it to my daughter, who lives in Hawaii. And she called me up. She says, "Dad, this is outstanding." She said, "This is the guy's son that probably saved Mom and my life." Holy Toledo. And you know the bad thing about it? She's probably right. But that was a real plus for me. My oldest daughter from my first marriage is 34 years old. She and Linda, my wife, are the two people that love me the most. They're the two most loyal, so I don't get myself in trouble at home. The other daughter that's ours between us is a little tougher, a little ornerier than the others. But these two people love me and they want my attention. And I had no time for them. My higher power has worked it to the point where my oldest daughter now has come to work for me. And we're getting a shot at a relationship. But what I can tell you about that is that that anger and temper still rules my life. It makes me uncomfortable in my own skin. It embarrasses and humiliates me and those people around me. And no good ever comes from it. But I still draw on it all the time, particularly when I'm under pressure or in some difficult situations. And it happened Thursday. The long-term employee and my daughter didn't do something I liked, and I blew up at both of them. Now, the fact I was right, it has no bearing on it. I'm still not cured yet. But what I did, I knew instantly that I had done a boo-boo. And it happened to be 11:15, and I came to the usual noon meeting. And God bless America, here's the topic, anger and temper. And I get called on. Trot on back. "I am sorry. Please forgive me. Make the amends." And I don't mean to say this. It's not funny, but this is part of what I've learned from you people in this room. I didn't allow it to get beyond what it was. I went. I made instant amends. I realized that just because I say I'm sorry doesn't do away with the fear and the intimidation that I place in these two people when I react that way. But I am getting better. And every morning I ask my higher power to give me that 10-second delay switch, like at the radio stations, so I can practice restraint of tongue and pen. And I am getting better. And I know that one day I'm going to wake up and those character defects are going to be gone from my life once and for all. My relationship with my wife has been fantastic. You know, it's hard to believe, because I still think she's a beautiful woman, and that's because she is. But she was 23 when I met her. And the chance that I could have blown all of that because of this is, you know, it never ceases to amaze me. But God was working in my life and has given me a second chance. And everybody in this room can have the second chance at life if they're just willing to come into the rooms, sit down and listen. I share some of these things with you today. I'm not proud of having struck women. but it's important for me to tell you that. And it's important because of the way I look. See, guys that look like me can still beat up their wives. Guys that look like me can still be afraid and still be scared of life and what goes on in life. There's one of our famous old guys in here. I don't even know how much time he has. Woody. Big man. And I heard him say very early on in my sobriety that we are people that would normally not mix. But you know what? When I drank, I mixed with everybody. I didn't care who, what, or where. I would drink with anybody. Where I've had trouble is mixing with people when I'm sober. Because when I walked into room 47, the Sunday meeting I told you about was full of nice gray-haired old men. When I started going to the noon meetings, holy Toledo. I mean, there were guys there with tattoos everywhere, long hair, motorcycles, leather jackets. And this was not where I wanted to be. And quite frankly, I was afraid. But another thing that took place there, another revelation in my life, there were a couple guys there in business suits, a couple businessmen. And you know what I can tell you? And this is on no way an inflection on a guy with a business suit. But the people that have helped me the most have been these guys that I described. And all of a sudden, they didn't have tattoos and they didn't look any different. They were being of help to me. And as I later found out, that's because they knew they were helping themselves too for passing it on. You know, my favorite people in this room are people that have worked in the trades and have done things that are not on the professional business level. And the thing that's so great about Alcoholics Anonymous is that they let me into their groups anyway. And I have to tell you, you know, I come here on a very regular basis. And, you know, at the meetings, they announce the name of the Friday night speaker during the meetings. And I got razzed every single day this week. But, you know, I really like that. I mean, I can't tell you how great I feel that I have been accepted in here. And you know, it's only by doing what I've seen others do. They talk about, I hear things about this group. People come in and say things about it, and that's probably the only time I get angry over AA. Because this group, I think it's safe to say, and I don't think my wife will disagree, I think it's safe to say this group saved my life and hers. And so it's pretty difficult for somebody to tell me there's a problem with Saturday Night Live. And you know what I've seen since I've been here? We've moved 3 to 4 times, whatever it is, and all of a sudden, some of those people that I saw in room 47 just for a little bit are starting to come back to this group. And that's because this group has everything going for it. Look at these meetings. I don't participate in a lot of the activities at Saturday Night Live because my number one priority is to take care of my wife and make amends for all the wreckage I created over those years. And she is not an alcoholic. And you probably say, well, how do you know she's an alcoholic? That she's not an alcoholic. Well, when I open the refrigerator and I look in there and there's a glass of wine with tin foil on top of it, you know that she's not an alcoholic. But one more thing, because I'm running out of time and running out of stories. I wanted to talk a little bit about Little John and John S. I go to that meeting in Los Gatos. on Saturday, and I work in San Jose, and so I'm driving over this hill every day, and it gets tiring. And I'm thinking, well, I come to Live all the time, and I can't really miss the Los Gatos meeting because I only go there once a week. So I think I'm going to start cutting out Sunday morning meetings and do it every other Sunday. So I'm looking for validation. Wrong decision. I come over here and I'm telling John and little John, you know, I'm driving over that hill every single day and I'm so tired and I think I should get a break. And what do you think? And they say, if it came to booze or women, you had gone a hell of a lot farther than that every single day. And you get your rear end over here to the meeting. And you know, I always make it clear to the two of them, because I've become very close to both of them. And so they usually know when I'm going. But you know, if I forget to say something, good friend Wayne back there and his wife's son are regulars at that meeting. And they come up, say, good to see you back. You know, are you all right? Where have you been? Harold is kind of a hit and miss Sunday morning guy, but I consider him a honorary member of the group. And you know, he's always there, and the fact that he's here tonight is very special as well. Thank you. So what I can tell you today is that my life has been very, very good since I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that if I continue to follow what I've been taught and what I see that goes on from this podium and what goes on in these rooms, that I can be sober as long as I choose. And you know, life is good enough today that I'm going to do one more day. Thanks.